Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
We coming to H-Town. Let's get to work in, man. Let's go.
Great day. Great day. Oh, give me some juice, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Let's do it.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Happy Thursday to all of you. Nice to be with you. Appreciate you getting up with us. We are with you till 10 a.m. this morning. He is Seth Payne, otherwise known as Pope Zaza. I am Sean Pendergast. But some of you affectionately and infuriatingly call me Pendy. I don't like Pendy. That at all. Not even one little bit, but is what it is.
It's better than tender ass.
Tender ass is what I got called at times as a youth. Yeah, that was not fun. The worst thing for me was people, when I was real young, Sean, as it's spelled, the way I spell it, wasn't a super popular name. Not that it's super popular now, but it wasn't as mainstream here.
Yeah.
I got called Scene by way more teachers than you would think. And that
there's nobody dumber sometimes than a substitute teacher with the pronunciation of names. I'm guessing it was a substitute teacher who came in and is taking attendance and says Scene Pendergast.
I don't remember. I just remember being a little kid and having people in positions of authority call me Scene and having it be very... very demoralizing.
You don't spell your name differently than the normal Sean, S-E-A-N. I got called Seath at times, and it was always, I can remember, by substitute teachers. Yeah. And you know, this might surprise you, Sean, but I was a little bit obstinate as a youth, and sometimes I would refuse to.
You don't say.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would refuse to say here.
Is there a Seath Pan in the crowd?
Seath Pan.
And I would just say mute until you put some respect on my name.
You get it right. Right. There's nobody in this room. They're going, Seath? And I wouldn't raise my hand either. There's nobody in this room named Seath.
Kind of backfired when I realized, oh, she's just going to mark me absent and yeah. then keep moving along.
When I didn't graduate the third grade, it was kind of an issue. Yeah.
Yeah, so I turned into a little bit more. I would make them say it a few times. And then I would say, it's Seth, lady. It's in the Bible, you know.
That's it. That's true. How you feeling this morning, my friend?
I feel good. I feel good. I feel ready for training camp. Yeah. I'm excited, but also prepared for that first 2 weeks of camp where you're all excited, you're amped up, and then you realize, there's really nothing happening here until this is how it happens at every training camp. Yeah, let's go. Football, baby. Woo! And then the first preseason game comes, and you're like, I don't know any of these guys.
Yeah.
All right. Woo! Let's go.
Okay.
And then we settle in.
Yeah. I would submit that this camp will be a little bit different than that just because of all the churn on the offensive line and seeing who's going to be, you know, what are the mixing and matching? What are the combos? Who's the first team they trot out there? Like, you're 100% spot on about excitement level gets up. Then you get out there and you go, okay, if you realize this is a grind and there's a whole lot of guys out here we don't know. We're talking about the starting offensive line for this team. We have no idea what it's going to look like.
And last year, I grew increasingly nervous about the offensive line as training camp wore on because, as we've said many times, Mario Edwards and all those guys looked like they were going to be all pro.
Foley Fatakasi was an amazing signing for this team.
They may as well have been a group of Aaron Donalds on the interior of the defensive line. And I was nervous about it, but I always try to give the O-line a pass because it's really hard without full contact to show everything. And I did the same thing during OTAs this year because I know, you know, Sarge, Big Sarge had said something about some concerns about the offensive line, and people were attacking him. And I said, look, man, it could go either way right now. I try not to read too much into non-padded practices when everything is new and it's a new scheme. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we get a couple weeks into camp and CJ can't get a playoff because you've got issues on the offensive line, I'm going to stop giving allowances for, hey, it's early, or hey, it's a new scheme. I'm going to freak the hell out.
Yeah, as you should. As you should. I mean, that was not fun last year watching CJ get hit as much as he did. So I'm excited for it. It's good. It'll be great to have football back in our lives. We're 6 days away. July 23rd, a week from yesterday, is the first practice out there at the Methodist Training Center. So we're excited about that. I went ahead and put my money where my mouth is, and I did an over wager on the Astros 92.5 yesterday.
Yeah.
You and I talked about this.
I think that's a good decision, Sean.
I think it is, too.
I think that losing five out of the last six games before the All-Star break was not a huge shot in the optimism arm.
Mm-mm.
My right arm is my optimism arm.
You're right.
But the... they're going to get some guys back from injury.
Yeah.
They just have to, Sean. Remember when I said at the beginning of the year there's no possible way they could be as injured
this year as they were last year?
Right now, I'm saying there's no possible way they don't get at least, let's say, a third of the guys who are on the IL back.
Yeah.
And I think that last stretch where you lose 5 out of 6 games, it very easily could have gone differently with 2 or 3 of those guys back from the IL.
Yeah. So. I don't know if numbers-wise they have more, because they had a ton of injuries last year. I don't know if quantity-wise there's more, but the impact is higher with these injuries. The mere fact that Yordan Alvarez has been a complete null set this year, at least with Kyle Tucker, like the equivalent last year for the Yordan injury was Kyle Tucker fouling a ball off his leg and missing 3 months of baseball. When Kyle Tucker was healthy, which was the first 2 months of the year, as opposed to Yordan, who played for a month, Kyle Tucker was an MVP candidate when he got hurt. Yordan was a negative 0.6 WAR when he got hurt. Like, you haven't had Yordan all season long. And so the teams in terms of just sheer games missed, it might be the same number of total games missed, but the fact that it's Yordan Alvarez injured and he played injured when he was actually playing and wasn't good, and that Jeremy Pena goes on this ascension, like Pena is kind of a little bit more of the Kyle Tucker equivalent injury in that he was an MVP candidate. He gets hurt breaking a bone on some freak injury. You know, he got hit by a pitch. Kyle Tucker hit a ball off his leg. Pena's going to come back, we hope, knock on wood, sooner than Tucker eventually came back. But you're right. They're very mirror images. And the pitching staff is just, I think it's very similar. It's just sheer quantity, like just sheer numbers. This is probably worse this year because 3/5 of the rotation that you were planning on coming into the season wiped out by like the end of April. It was crazy.
I think if we compared to last year, which feels so similar in so many ways, except the Astros have lifted themselves up more aggressively than they did last year. There's also the slow starts by various people. Paredes off to a slow start, but then now A-OK just fine.
Yeah.
Pena got off to a slow start. Yiner Diaz got off to an atrociously slow start, and he's still been very streaky. But on the sum total of it, since May 1st, Yiner's been, at the very least, an average guy at the plate. Defensively, I'm not super enthusiastic about his progression as an actual.
But you knew that. You knew that going in. Like you're hitting wise, you were counting on him to be really what he's been over the first couple weeks of July. He's been excellent. Yeah. You know, that's what you're counting on.
Look at last year. Some of the young guys you didn't know about, Hunter Brown and Spencer Arrighetti.
Yeah.
Just flat out didn't know. Hunter Brown looked like he might not be fit for Major League Baseball early in 2024, and this year it's been much, much different. So the development or coming off of a slow start of either your rookies or veterans, it feels very similar this year as to how it felt last year. The injuries and the impact those guys can have when they come back, I'm probably more optimistic right now. I mean, some of the injuries, obviously Blanco, he ain't coming back. Last year, you had guys that just flat out weren't coming back. But if half of the pitchers who are on the IL right now and who are within a month or so come back, that's a huge, huge boost.
Well, Arrighetti's not a Tommy John, so I'm counting on him being after a couple rehab starts or whatever, being what we counted on him being. If they get one of Javier and Luis Garcia back, I'll be over the moon. If they get Arrighetti and one of those two guys back, and they're what they were, if they're 85% of what they were in the year they won the World Series a couple of years ago, I'll be thrilled. That's why I placed the wager. In the everyday lineup, they're going to get Yordan back. Now, there's reports now that Yordan, whatever condition they get him back in, he might be playing through some stuff. Chandler Rome had that yesterday, so it may not be. You know, Yordan may be dealing with some things, but he's going to make it back. Jeremy Pena is going to make it back. I feel confident in that in the everyday lineup. And then Arrighetti, and I would bet on Javier over Garcia just based on the reports. The weakness of the schedule, it's the second easiest schedule, and I know they play down to their cup, whatever. I'd rather play an easy schedule than a hard schedule the second half of the season. And then I think one or both of Christian Walker or Yiner Diaz, and Yiner's already kind of, as you pointed out, he's kind of already started to, in a good way, regress to the mean here. You know, he's started to, the gravitational pull of a high 700, 800 OPS has started to pull him back in. Christian Walker, I'm not as confident in just because he's looked so uncompetitive at the plate at times. But those are all reasons why I think they're going to be just as good in these last 66 games as they were in the first 96 games.
This is why Yiner is so important, Sean. And like, I'm cherry picking this a little bit, but Yiner's OPS in wins, 799.
Yeah.
Yiner's OPS in losses, 520.
Okay.
This team goes as Yiner Diaz goes, Sean.
I did that exercise because
you can do that with a lot of guys.
No, it's that way with you're right. Yeah. It's that way with a lot. No, the biggest one was Yordan last year. I went through that exercise of looking at all the mainstay guys.
Yeah.
What it was. And that's another thing. Like the most jarring one of those is Yordan Alvarez. Like Yordan when he in wins, at least last season, like 1,100, 1,200 OPS, some crazy number. And then like a Yiner number here for in losses. You know, I like that. It's a good cherry pick by you, though.
And Yiner, really, I think you and I are a little bit different on where we are with how we feel about Yiner at the plate. He's been inconsistent, to be sure, but if you just break it down by month, April was just atrocious for him. He had a 515 OPS.
Yeah, yeah.
May, he had a 795 OPS.
Yeah.
Hey, and I was arguing, look, man, everybody's got to calm down. And then in June, 658 OPS.
Right.
But then in July so far, he's up at an 883 OPS.
No, we're on the same page. We're on the same page on that. I'm with you on that. That's the frustrating thing about Yiner, and I would say Christian Walker too, is that unlike Jose Abreu last year and the year before, when he just never got out of first gear, there were other than September of 2023, Jose Abreu was one of the worst hitters in baseball. Christian Walker and Yiner have at least shown flashes this year. You know.
Sorry, I thought for some reason I heard something different than September. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. Christian Walker and Yiner, like they've shown flashes. That's what's frustrating. It's more lack of consistency than an inability to even do it at all.
Well, and the other big thing about the pitchers coming back, especially, is that not everybody that's injured right now is going to come back at all or come back the same version of themselves. But when things are as precariously perched as they are, that the starting pitching just makes such a big difference.
Yeah.
It's if Hunter Brown is classic Hunter Brown, you got a really good chance of winning that game. If he can go six innings and send it to the bullpen, hey, we got a shot at getting one of these one-run leads. If Hunter or Fromber or any of the other starting pitchers struggle, it becomes really, really difficult.
Yeah.
To squeak one out when you've already let up four runs in the first few innings.
Yep. All right. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Thursday. 713-572-4610 if you want to weigh in. That's our text page. The numbers are out from Vegas on quarterbacks and stats this year. And I'm telling you right now, if Nick Caley is who he's supposed to be, you're going to cash in on C.J. Stroud. We'll share the numbers with you. And C.J. Gardner-Johnson on his new quarterback as well. We'll do that coming up next. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Text message, headed to Vegas tonight, guys. Got to get my bets in. After years, I'm going to start signing my texts to you guys. LOL. That's from Max. Here's the thing about that, Max, and the rest of you texting. We joked about this yesterday because we played audio from Arch Manning, who said that his grandfather, Archie Manning, signs all his texts to his grandkids. When you're signing texts to people that you know or family members, that's an old person thing. It's actually helpful for us to acknowledge you if you sign the text to our show. We like that.
Right.
Part. Yeah.
Yeah, that really helps a lot. We used to have a text system where you could identify, you could label somebody's name, and it was very, very helpful.
It was.
Now it's not so different, especially because there's sometimes look, there's one guy in the text line who just hates me. Just hates me. And there's nothing I can say or do that isn't the dumbest thing that he's ever seen. And so I know his number by now, and I can kind of just disregard it. But it's a lot easier in the early stages if I could be like, okay, Chuck from Pearland is a guy that just hates me or whatever. I don't like blocking people off the text line because then the other shows that might be able to use the Chuck from Pearland or whomever he is that hates me. For my own mental health, I really, really wish someday they'll listen to my recommendation that we get a text system where we can identify names. If you hate me, sign your name afterwards.
Sign your name.
If you love me, likewise.
Yeah, yeah. Either way, it is very helpful on this system. Kidding aside, to sign your name on it. Here was C.J. Gardner-Johnson, new Texan safety. He was a guest on the Pivot podcast this week. And this was C.J. Gardner-Johnson talking about his new quarterback, C.J. Stroud.
Competitor. A dog, and willing to lead. I play a lot of, Drew was one of those quarterbacks willing to lead us. And getting shipped to Philly was kind of a blessing. Because, you know, being in New Orleans, you know, the situation was hard. So we're looking for a leader. It's easy when you gravitate around a leader like Jalen. So when coming to another team, it's like, you don't got to say much. You just sit back and just encourage them. That's the only thing you can do with those type of quarterbacks, because you can't put too much on their plate. They got a lot going on. So if I can just be that teammate, like, bro, you him.
That's pretty high praise, man. I mean, he's played with Drew Brees, Jalen Hurts, and Jared Goff. Those have been the quarterbacks on the teams he's played on. So he's putting CJ in that company right there from a leadership standpoint.
What did he say? Getting what to Philly?
Oh, I don't. I'm not sure.
I thought he said, I guess he meant championship or something, but he said getting shipped to Philly. Reed Blankenship? I don't know if he was talking about him.
Maybe getting shipped to Philly. Like,
oh, getting shipped to Philly.
Yeah,
okay,
that's how I
got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I have to listen to CJ Gardner-Johnson clips a couple times sometimes.
He's a good storyteller, but he's all over the place.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
He's very choppy.
Yeah. I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
So yeah, sometimes he'll go somewhere, he'll pivot and veer off somewhere. So sometimes I'm not quite sure what the hell he's talking about.
Yeah.
I think that part of it, his early impressions of the Texans have been cool, because CJ Gardner-Johnson, if you watch that entire interview, it's an hour long and it doesn't feel like an hour because it's very good. It's really interesting to kind of hear about how he's grown as a player and how he's processed things in terms of understanding how much he can be fully himself or when he needs to dial it back at times, but then also the way teams need to operate in championship environments, especially, and that it is a notch above. I think he might be one of the unexpected guys that a lot of people maybe who knew him when he was a younger guy don't realize that, wow, he's learned a lot and really understands the team dynamic of a lot of things. So the way he's talked about CJ, in that we played the clip yesterday where he's talking about Kalen Bullock and Jalen Petrie and Azeez Alshire, I take that at 100%. It's a valid opinion that he has of them from whatever his limited impression is right now.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the New Orleans teams he was on, but he's not been on bad teams. You know, he was in New Orleans at the end of the Drew Brees era. He's in Philly for a year when they go to a Super Bowl. He's in Detroit for a year when they probably should have gone to a Super Bowl if Dan Campbell had made some different decisions and they had a real kicker in the NFC Championship game. And then he won a Super Bowl last year. You know, and I'm not saying, like, hey, CJ Gardner-Johnson's the reason these teams, but he's seen what good looks like. There's a lot, he's banked a lot of, I think there is something to bringing in these guys who have played on these championship level teams.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and he's seen different quarterbacks operate, and exactly, they're all different. They all lead in different ways, but there's a certain cachet you hope your guy has. I think, and, you know, Clint, they played that promo of Clint talking about how the leadership has to come from CJ for about a week this past week, so I know most people have heard it. And I agree with Clint, and I think CJ is wired that way, but it is also, there's only so much you can do when you're a young quarterback that you have to grow into whatever the eventual version of yourself is.
Yeah.
And last year was a tough year to do it, where I think a lot of things were off kilter. So I just don't have any concerns about it.
No.
I don't think that young Eli Manning. Eli Manning will talk about it himself. I've talked to people who worked with the Giants who helped Eli work on leadership. They brought in a company called Afterburner one year, which is specifically a lot of they kind of use military mission planning tactics to teach leadership.
Yeah.
And it was really big for Eli Manning because they put him in a position where he was leading meetings. He was the one, you know, correcting things and everything. In football, they loved that. It's the worst, man, because they love to pretend they're in the military and then they ask guys to be leaders and everything. But most teams do a horrible job of actually defining or teaching leadership.
Yeah.
So they're like, hey, be a leader. Yeah. And guys are just kind of 23-year-old guys are kind of left to be like, okay, I guess I'm going to be the movie version of a leader.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to be whatever my high school football coach was. So when they did it with Eli Manning, and they did it for the Giants in total, I talked to Coughlin about this too, that it's kind of a systemic approach to the way the military uses to teach officers how to be leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you do is, give them opportunities to actually lead.
Right.
It's not about, You know, hey, go be a leader. But I'm running the meetings, and I'm the one doing the film, and I'm doing all that. And I go, no, let the guy actually lead some things.
Dude.
Let Eli be a junior lieutenant for a while, at the very least.
Especially Eli. Like kicking him into the deep end of the leadership pool.
Yeah.
Feels like a disaster.
Oh, no, that company, I don't think they're around anymore, but they'd worked with a few pro sports teams, and I loved it. I had a friend who worked with Afterburner, and I went and did their training and everything.
It's cool.
And I ended up applying it. Brandy and I kind of used it to change the way she watched film with her players.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of cool stuff. I could do a whole podcast on it.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of it allows people to be leaders partly by kind of you take the names out of it, where like when you're breaking down a play, you don't say, hey, Jim, you got to make this play. You're like, okay, so the left guard on this play really needs to, you know, we need to be sure the left guard does this or that. So it kind of, it tries to take sensitivity out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really cool because a lot of old crusty football coaches will be like, yeah, you're too sensitive. Where meanwhile, the Navy SEALs and fighter pilots are recognizing, like, okay, yeah, you know what? Human beings have a tendency to get sensitive. We don't have time for that.
Yeah.
We got an important mission here, so we'll take the opportunity for sensitivity out of it, and we're going to take rank out of it. So you can criticize what your leader should have done. You know, in very specific scenarios.
It's not like cool.
You can't walk up to him in the chow hall and be like, hey. Hey, bum. It's cool.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
And that helped Eli be a better leader.
Yep. Won two Super Bowls. So the numbers are out on C.J. Stroud and all the quarterbacks in the NFL. Vegas has put the numbers out. If you believe in Nick Caley as an offensive coordinator, I think you can cash in big on C.J. Stroud this year. His numbers on his prop bets for futures are very, very much reflective of the season he had last year than the season he had in his rookie year. The passing yards number is 3,800 and a half. So
he was at 3,727 last year.
And he was at 4,100 and change his rookie year. And that was missing two games with concussions, with a concussion. So that's number one. Number two, the touchdown passes, 21 and a half. He had 20 last year, 23 his rookie year. The big one for me is interceptions. You know, if you believe in Nick Caley, I don't think C.J. Stroud's a double-digit interception guy. I think he's closer to the 5 interceptions his rookie year than the 12. The 12 that he threw last year, and it felt like more than 12 just because he was so careful with the football his rookie year.
Yeah.
But it boils down to two simple things. One, he's got to be healthy, obviously. If you're going over on these numbers, he's got to stay healthy. That's number one. I feel confident he's a guy, CJ, that doesn't put himself in harm's way. Number two, if you feel like Nick Caley can get rookie CJ back, then I think the numbers are going to fall in line with that.
I think with young quarterbacks, I always flash back to adjusting the V hold on your television. Remember adjusting the vertical hold?
Yeah, flip and flip.
You turn it to the right a little bit, dude. And it doesn't. You turn it to the left, and I'm like, I'm not sure. You say you turn a little bit more, and I'm like, I don't know. So you're trying to find the right V hold.
Oh my God.
On the UHF stations, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
Last year, it felt like they were on one of the UHF stations where CJ's trying to figure out his appetite for risk. And okay, when can you push the envelope? When can you not? Maybe my rookie year, I was a little too conservative at times. Last year, the offense is struggling. Maybe I need to be a little bit more aggressive in instances. So it takes some time to get the V hold right.
Yeah.
On that. And you got to be constantly managing it. Weather conditions can change things.
Dude, what's the oldest person listening right now that even knows what the V hold is, do you think?
I'm guessing 45? Anybody under the age of 34 thinks
has no
I'm
clue.
Making some kind of dirty joke.
Yeah, the V hold.
Is he talking about the soccer?
I gotta go to Urban Dictionary and see what this V-hold is.
Yeah, so kids, there used to be on the old cathode ray televisions, you had to kind of adjust whether, I don't even know what it was. I know I did it for like 20 years of my life, but I don't know exactly what I was adjusting.
Oh, dude.
It kept the lines from showing up.
Yeah, you needed like some surgeon-like precision on certain TVs just to get it just right so the picture would stay on the screen.
It was, you made it to watch to watch Welcome Back, Kotter, you basically had to turn into some kind of radio operator from the Korean War.
Oh.
You're just sitting in there. You got the you're dialed in. You're trying to get the static out of it. Yeah.
Should I take the over on all? Should I take over yards, over touchdown passes, under interceptions, Seth?
I think you should take the over. You know, I was just kind of as a guidepost because the Texans are gonna probably really focus on running the football this year.
No doubt. That's why I'm a little nervous on that one.
So if you look at Justin Herbert, where last year they were very run heavy. A lot of times the offense almost seemed like it was managing Justin Herbert, and people were making impassioned pleas for, hey, you got to put more respect on Justin Herbert's name because they're running the ball so much. He had 3,870 yards last year, 23 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. So if that, and I think CJ in this offense will be more aggressive.
I agree.
Nick Cayley will probably be a little bit more aggressive downfield. They're going to want to set up, use the play action a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got the ability to set up those deep shots with Nico, obviously. So I think I would feel very comfortable taking the over as long as CJ stays healthy.
Yeah, it's a bet on Cayley. It's a bet on Cole Popovich to a degree as well, mm-hmm. right? Like the offensive line doesn't improve. Then CJ gets hit, and that's where the injury factor could come in. Okay, good. Now, Nico's number I saw yesterday, and this is if you're betting Nico Collins receiving yards, 1,150, if he's healthy, he's going to sail past that. You're basically betting on Nico Collins' health if you're betting on 1,150 receiving yards with Nico. I mean, for some context, when he got hurt last year in week 5, he was on pace for almost 2,000. He was on like a 1,900 yard pace when he got hurt last year. Slowed down, obviously, but he still got 1,000 yards, even with a slower second half of the season. He still got over 1,000 yards while missing 5.5 games last year. Well, really almost 6, because they took him out of that week 18 game as well once he went over 1,000 yards. So that's another one. A little more betting advice for you. Hey, the second round logjam might be over. The Nick Caserio caused second round logjam from guaranteeing Jaden Higgins.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, the Texans guaranteed Jaden Higgins' contract. The Browns guaranteed their number one pick in the second round.
Yeah.
They guaranteed his contract. First time in history that they've been guaranteed, and then no second round picks had signed after that.
Until now. Alfred Collins, the second round pick, I believe, of the 49ers, San Francisco reached a contract agreement with defensive tackle Alfred Collins on Wednesday night. He's the 43rd overall pick, so he's 9 picks after Jaden Higgins. They guaranteed, without, I'm doing the numbers in my head, Seth, he signs a 4-year, $10.3 million deal, $9 million guaranteed. So they guarantee about 80, it looks like high 80s, like 88% of it.
Texans Cap did a good article about where the trends and how much of the money's been guaranteed, and he showed that it really wasn't that much of a leap to give in guaranteed money to give Jaden Higgins that. And I agree with him there. He's like, it was kind of headed this way. This is a little bit of a jump above where the graph would show you. But there is also still that psychological part of it that it would, whatever the line on the graph looks like, I think there are probably a lot of GMs that are just flat out like, man, once we do that, then there's no going back. And at some point, the slippery slope takes hold. So it's somewhere in between with those. I think but given that one more guy and a little bit lower down the board at 43, that gives hopefully a good chance at Ariante Ursary, who's at 48, and everybody else after 43 just kind of slots in now.
As you just said, it's been creeping that way every year. The 34th overall pick last year, whoever it was, got 92% of their contract guaranteed, and it's been creeping up by like 2 or 3% every year.
Yeah.
Nick just said screw it and gave the rest of the 8% to Jaden Higgins. So that's probably, if I had to guess, the Alfred Collins signing at 43 overall is, he's at like 88% guaranteed. Maybe last year's guy was at like 81% or something like that.
This is one of those things, everybody, we're probably going to have Nick on during the second week of training camp before practice. It's one of those ones where I want to ask him about it, but I just don't know. I don't want to waste a question because this gets into such specifics that I don't think he'd really divulge much, but there's a part of me, I was talking to Texans Cap about this, that it just feels like Nick, it kind of does the, He does the time management of, like, listen, haggling over a couple extra percentage points of guaranteed money versus just getting this out of the way so we can focus on other things. It feels like Nick does just say, look, this is dumb. It's not a big deal. I'm just going to do it this way.
And if that's the answer, we have to ask the question, because this has been a big story around the league the last few days. We've been in a dead headlines period right now, but this has been a big story around the league the last few days.
We'll do it this way. He likes it when I give him a chance to make me look like a moron. And I'll say, look, this is my theory, Nick. Yeah. And then he can either say, we'll only give him one choice. Either Seth, you're an idiot, or Seth, you're brilliant.
Yeah.
So, and he's likely to go, Seth, you're an idiot. But he's going to want to explain why I'm an idiot.
Sure. Yeah. He's going to want to be courteous about calling you an idiot. Now everybody's signing their names on the text. This is a good thing.
Yes. Thank you.
There's two things going on. People telling us on the text page that they don't hate you. Because of that one guy.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, a lot of people say
I wasn't fishing for compliments, I promise.
No, but they're coming in. And then a lot of people just signed, good morning, guys. Signed Bobby from Katie, non-hater of Seth. So he had both of them. All right.
Don't worry. I'm not crying at night over it. It's one of the best things about this job I've learned is that you learn that just some people are going to hate you no matter what.
That's what it is.
And you just got to live with it. It's like just, just go with it.
That's it. Headlines. Sad news in the world, I guess Texans world. That we will get to in headlines, and also big news, big shakeups in the broadcasting world that will affect your college football viewing this coming season. That is coming up next.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines, presented by Men's Tea Clinic.
All right, we'll start off. Sad news in the world of football. Former Houston Texans and Philadelphia Eagles linebacker Brian Braman, who had been suffering from an aggressive form of brain cancer, passed away early this morning, after seeking treatment for this rare aggressive form of cancer. He was 38 years old. Some of you may have seen this story recently. There had been a GoFundMe set up for Brian Braman to deal with some of the expenses in treating the cancer. He was diagnosed back in February. So, very aggressive. They had raised $88,000 to help him. J.J. Watt, probably the most high-profile donation. He donated $10,000. A lot of other teammates chipping in. Emmanuel Acho went public. He was a teammate of his on the Eagles, trying to get money for him to treat it. Brian Braman passes away, leaves behind two daughters, ages 11 and 8. He played from 2011 to 2017. Many of you remember him coming into the league with the Texans as a primo special teams player. His last game he played in, Seth, the Super Bowl victory over the Patriots back in the 2017 season.
Yeah, and I think, a fan favorite probably in both Houston and Philadelphia. There's like so many iconic images of him just like flying down the field, bloody face, helmet off at times. And he was a special teams maven. He was just the best version of the word, a psychotic special teams player.
Yes.
And looked the part and was really a part. The big thing about Braman was his first year was in 2011, so right when the Texans really poured it on defensively and in terms of special teams and that whole, you had a different feel about those teams than you had with previous versions of the Texans.
That's the first really, really, really good Texans team in 2011.
Yeah.
He was there
So
that was, that's sad. 38 years old, man. Yeah, Brian Braman, if you hadn't seen that, he passed away early this morning. So RIP, thoughts and prayers to his family. Astros Mariners start up tomorrow. I would say, we'll talk more Astros a little later in the show. This is as big a series as the Astros have played in this year, Seth, just considering how they limped into the break and how the Mariners are ascending going in. They swept the best team in the American League, the Tigers, going into the break. So these are two teams that, at least in this really short near term, are moving kind of in different directions. The Astros still have a big lead. Look, they could walk out of this series in Seattle over the weekend, either with the Mariners right on their heels at two games or having buried the Mariners eight games behind them. Like, this is a big swing series coming up
here. And this is where I think the big one, obviously, you've got all the questions that we've had for a while now about some of the injuries, but the Hunter Brown and how much of it, him scuttling a little bit before the All-Star break, was hopefully just fatigue or maybe tipping his pitches a little bit. And do you see a rejuvenated and refreshed version of Hunter Brown? It's not like he had 2 months off or something.
Right.
It's an extra skip of a rotation, basically. Yeah. But that's my non of all the things that we haven't been talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks, that's the short-term concern.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's been so good. This is one of those things like, wow, this just popped up. Hunter struggling. This hasn't happened in a long time.
And Bagwell was, you know, I told you, whenever a guy like Bagwell, who's kind of a crusty old vet, who's, he's kind of wired like a lot of us are. We're like, these modern athletes are too soft. Yeah. When Bagwell is talking about how the fatigue is real, and especially with younger players, it's just, it's you got to learn your first couple seasons really how to work through that.
Yep.
Hopefully Hunter's learned some things from last year to help him out this year.
Bagwell definitely knows what the V-hold is on an old school TV. For sure. For sure.
He might
still have one. Bagwell.
He probably does. He probably didn't want his kids to be spoiled by flat screen TVs.
Right.
So he's got a huge chunk of a block of plastic and cathode ray tube in his rec room.
Yeah. Technology's not going to hold that picture in place. You're going to do it, all right? Like we did.
See some of these clips on YouTube from the early 2000s, and it's in standard definition of sporting events.
Yeah.
Like, how did sports ever become
it's
popular?
It's so poverty, man.
I cannot watch this.
Yeah.
What the hell? These blurbs of color moving across. I might as well be watching Tecmo Bowl.
There's all this unused space on my screen right now on both sides.
Oh, yeah, not to mention, the aspect ratio.
Yeah, the aspect ratio. Yeah, yeah.
What's going on to his left? What's going on to his right?
Hey, speaking of TV, we know that I don't know how many of you watched the, FS1 and ESPN and all the debate shows and things like that. But Fox Sports 1 had 5 debate shows that they ran throughout the day up against ESPN's Get Up and First Take and PTI and all those. They blew out 3 of the 5 shows this week and fired everybody. Well, I say they fired everybody. Some of them might come back on new shows. It looks like now, Seth, that was part of a process of getting Fox and Barstool integrated with one another. And that the big thing out of this is Dave Portnoy, the founder of Barstool, who I know many of our listeners, look, we've played him on Take a Mania at least a couple of times.
Yeah.
He is reportedly going to wind up on Big Noon Saturday, the FS1 Fox version of College Game Day.
Yeah.
Which is hosted by my best friend from high school, Rob Stone. He's going to wind up on their set as what's being kind of framed as like their answer to McAfee.
Yeah, I could just see Portner going into this flat out planning on getting fired from the show at some point.
Yeah, I mean, Portnoy doesn't need the money. Like, Portnoy's worth hundreds of millions of dollars from selling Barstool and then buying it back for a buck.
I think when McAfee sort of joined up with ESPN, I think a lot of people thought, like, oh, boy, I don't know. He's a live wire. I don't know if he's going to make it or not because he and he's kind of pushed the envelope a little bit. I could see. I mean, Portnoy's just – whether you like or dislike Portnoy, there's only a certain level of kowtowing he's going to do, I think. Like, I don't know if I give him – this isn't a criticism of him at all. Just the way he's wired – I don't know if he'll make it a season.
I think
he could be the most popular guy on that show, and I think he's going to just because it's in his DNA.
Yeah.
He's gonna want at some point. He's like, I'm gonna piss this guy off. This guy that could fire me, I'm gonna piss him off.
The big reason I'll watch is to watch the interplay between him and Urban Meyer, because Meyer is a card carrying Ohio State guy, and Portnoy is a Michigan guy. So I think they're gonna go at it with each other. I honestly think the comparison with him and McAfee is a little lazy to me. I mean, at the surface, they're both very loud, non-traditional types of hosts. McAfee at least played football. Portnoy didn't play football. Not that that matters for what they're looking for out of Portnoy. The biggest difference, though, is McAfee is a big personality, but he's not a heel. He's not a bad guy. Like, he's just loud and very, he cuts through. I think he likes being liked. Anytime his radio show or his YouTube show, whatever we want to call it, brushes up against controversy, he's very quick to go, hey, we're not here to be negative. Like, remember when Aaron Rodgers was saying all the stuff he was saying? Like, we don't want to brush up against this. We're here for we're here to be a positive outlet. Yeah. Portnoy does not give an F, man.
Yeah.
He is a heel, and he doesn't care. And I think that's a very different – I think the two bring actually a very different dynamic. If you want to know the truth,
I think it's honestly, it feels a little bit it's a very boomer bust thing. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It's entertainment.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by it because There's no part of Portnoy, like you mentioned. He doesn't. It's not like he needs the money. there's no part of him that's going to, I think, step back or be less than himself because producers want him to be or anything. And I don't know. Remember when one of the podcasts got a deal with ESPN and it lasted all of about 18 hours?
Yeah, it wasn't
because people found out that, wait a second, they said, what about what?
Right.
I'm curious. This will be interesting. This will be really interesting.
Very interesting. I mean, just fitting him in. I mean, it's already a crowded set. You got Mark Ingram, Brady Quinn, Matt Leinart, and you got four guys plus a host already.
It's a smart move as far as trying to appeal to people in their 20s, or a lot of people who might be like just flat out not watching as much television anymore, and might be on a lot of younger men who might be on their phones instead of watching the pregame might be more likely to watch the pregame with Portnoy.
I think it's a good move. I'm with you. I think it's a good move. How it works out is going to be fascinating, no doubt.
Yeah.
I've come across the single worst top 100 list of all time when it comes to NFL players, particularly heading into this season. We will share with you why it is so bad, and we'll check and see. The last top 10 list for ESPN is going to be out probably within the next 5 minutes. Cornerbacks, where does Derek Stingley and Kamari Lassiter, where do they stack up in the NFL? We'll get to that coming up next.